You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
It's Wednesday, the 15th of May, 2024, and you're listening to Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. And today we're focusing on a specific topic, one that is of perennial concern, namely recruitment and the ongoing skills shortage. And to help us look into this, we have someone whose job it is to help plug the widening skills gap. He's Greg Shaw, London Regional Director with recruitment firm Randstad. Phil, you're there as well.
I'm here. Hello, David. Morning.
Hi there. Good morning. Good morning, Greg. Thanks for joining us. I forgot to welcome you to the podcast. As I said, it's of a perennial concern to the industry, recruitment and the skills shortage. And it has. I think it's probably getting worse. And certainly Randstad seems to think it is getting worse. We ran a news story a couple of weeks ago where your UK managing director was warning that with big infrastructure projects coming up in the pipeline, soon we're going to see a real worsening of the skills shortage. He used some fairly strong language, in fact. I mean, he said, let me see if I can find the quote.
He likened it to a water fight, didn't
That's
he?
That's right. He said, yes. He said, I think that what's going to happen is going to make the 2007 skills shortage or battle for jobs look like a water. So we've got a crisis looming. But I thought we'd start off by talking about what a recruitment agent does. I mean, that's basically your job to match employees with employers, fill the jobs that are available. So what does a recruitment agent do?
Well, first of all, thank you both for having me on the podcast today, Phil and David. Yeah, yes, for those that don't know or are unaware of what a recruitment consultant agent, what their role is, it's to ultimately work with your partner clients to fill their recruitment needs from whatever level. It could be a freelance contract need. It could be a permanent need. You could be working on a retained assignment for them. But ultimately, it's to plug the gap that they've got in their workforce.
Is the recruitment business a sort of a relatively recent phenomenon? Because, I mean, I think we're familiar, people of my generation, mine and Phil's generation, are familiar with headhunters, people who would go out and, you know, find people at a very high level of expertise, you know, people, chief executives and senior directors to, find the best possible people for very important senior jobs. But is it right? Am I right in thinking that actually, it's not just the senior people now that you recruit? You recruitment goes across the board from labourers right up to CEOs.
Yeah, absolutely. Like any industry, you've got different guises and different verticals in which you operate in. So the example that you just gave is very much a retained-based headhunting recruitment process, where there is the world that I will operate in is a contingency-based recruitment market. So, and that will be anything from blue-collar to white-collar.
So do you actually do headhunting as well, Greg? Are you ringing up people saying, You may not be happy in your job, I can get you more money, come and work for my client instead?
Yes, absolutely. There's always that passive market that isn't looking probably right now, but there might be an opportunity that unbeknownst to them could be absolutely ideal for their current situation. And that's where the partnership from a recruitment agency and the clients that they're working with and really understanding why they're looking, what their USPs are, is so integral to the construction market and the recruitment market as a whole.
I never encountered any recruitment agents when I was early in my career, and I suppose sort of still, you know, looking towards career development. I was thinking about this very recently, actually, because my daughter, who's in her late 20s, she's a surveyor. She works in London, and she's constantly talking to recruitment agents. Yeah. She is in constant dialogue with them about her career, and you know, she's been in her present job for a year, she's already thinking of moving on, but she's always looking one step ahead. And I sometimes think, why wasn't I speaking to people like this when I was, you know, early on in my career and didn't really know where I was going and what the opportunities were.
So they assumed you were too expensive, David. I used to get called. The first time I got a call, I thought it was such an ego trip. I was called by a headhunter saying, you know, we think this, you're the perfect person for this. And I thought, this is fantastic. Someone's noticed me. I'm obviously fantastic.
Well, you're so, lucky, you know, Phil. I never got the call.
With my inflated ego, I went along to this interview and completely flunked it and said, we don't want you. And I realised that actually it's a headhunter's job to put people in front of the interview panel, not necessarily to decide that I was any good or not, just that I was vaguely on paper appropriate.
Well, yeah. A good recruiter will be able to guide you on that process and make sure that you are the appropriate person for that interview. You don't want to be going there to make up the numbers. That's where the relationship between a recruiter and a candidate and the client is really, really important. And that's where the best recruiters will do well. And when they have those relationships and they have that experience, now that understanding of why you, Phil, are potentially on the horizon looking out and what your motivators, what would ideally you be looking for, what are you unhappy about? That's our job, to understand all those factors.
Well, it hasn't happened to me for a very long time, which brings me on to my next question, Greg. In the past 6 months, how old is the oldest person you've rung up to try and recruit for a job?
Oh, wow.
I reckon the calls stop when you hit your 40s.
No, absolutely not. I wouldn't be able to give you an exact number on that, but it's about skill. David mentioned it earlier. It's like that skill shortage. That the skill shortage isn't defined by age. Yes, we know the construction industry, more so than many other industries, is an aging has an aging population with it. And since 2008, we've been hemorrhaging staff to the tune of nearly 500,000. It was 2.6 million back in 2008 to back in 2023. It was just shy of 2.1 million. So there is a big skills gap, and we need to make sure that employers have got a bulletproof long-term workforce plan to address that. And that's probably what we're here today to talk about. Whatever market you're in, the best person for the job will be the right person for the job. And that's where age doesn't come. It shouldn't matter about age, ethnicity, gender. We know the construction industry has a lot of work to do from a diversity perspective. And generally, the market will hone in on, well, that's a gender inequality. Well, it is. We've got a gender issue in the construction industry, but we also have an ethnicity issue. We also have a neurodiverse issue. It's the whole spectrum of diversity which construction really needs to adapt to and start fishing in these pools to narrow this skills gap.
There's been a lot
of talk about those sort of diversity issues, but the age one seems to not be talked about, I don't think. It seems to be not on the... No one seems to, you know...
I don't believe it's a fact. I don't know, Phil, I don't know your experience around this, but I can only talk from my experience, and it's not a factor that's ever considered as, oh, do we submit X or Y? Well, no, it's who's the best candidate for this job? Well, the best candidate will be submitted.
I suppose one thing that maybe a lot of people would assume sort of mitigates against recruiting older people is that, you know, they've got less in the tank, as it were. I mean, they're already well into their career, perhaps in the sort of latter quarter of their career. They're not a long-term prospect for an employer. But I know this is something, a point that you made recently, Phil, which was people tend to move jobs very frequently now. So maybe recruiting somebody in their mid-60s isn't such a disadvantage compared to recruiting somebody in their early 30s, because they might be moving on in a few years anyway. Is that a fair point?
Well, a few months in many cases. It seems to be a very flighty world these days, not just construction, but I think, you know, when I was starting out my career in my 20s and 30s, it seemed to be 7 years seemed to be a respectable length of time to be in a job and then think, okay, I've learnt the job, I've moved, advanced my career, and now it's time to look for something else. Now it seems to be like 18 months people are thinking, I've done a year here, time to move on.
Is that fair? In the construction industry, it's slightly different to a lot of the other verticals within the UK, because it's project-led. And if you're
for many, but not for all.
But I think the world of work is changing, and how people view work and their approach to it and their motivators, and particularly post COVID, there is so much more fluidity when it comes to, okay, well, I want to be involved on this project, or I very much would like to be involved with a company and work for a company who values X, Y, or Z. And if that means that you then have to leave a job after 1 year, 2 years, 18 months, 3 years, whatever it may be, there's more opportunity to do so now than I think there has ever been. And as long as you're working with a partner agency such as ourselves, or you've got a very good internal recruitment team for a tier one contractor, whoever it may be, the opportunities to reach out and to connect with people are greater than they've ever been.
If you're looking at a candidate and you're looking at their CV and their work experience, do you have a sense of, if they're jumping around, if they had 10 jobs in 10 years, do you think, that's a bit flighty? And if someone had had the same job for 20 years, you think, oh, they're not very ambitious. And I imagine there's a balance in recruiters' minds as to what the optimum is.
There's always a balance, Phil.
I mean, obviously, it depends on the job.
And any recruiter worth its weight will always take references. So is there a reason that candidate X has had 10 jobs in 10 years? Is there something that we need to be aware of? People's circumstances change over time, personally, motivations, whatever it may be. Someone might have been a career person their whole life. But I think where the world's changing, particularly from a hiring perspective, and this isn't just in construction industry, this is in every industry at the moment, is moving away from the experience CV-based hiring process to very much a skills-based hiring process. And that's the real big pivotal shift that we're approaching in the talent acquisition market right now. And that's I can only talk from the clients that we partner with, and I sit down in front of their HRDs, their MD, CFOs, whatever. There are those that are really going into the next 2-3 years with their eyes wide open about the sort of talent shortage that we face. And there are those that are just happy to meander forward, and they'll deal with that issue when it arises. But we have to look at that skills-based hiring, but we've also got to be looking at reskilling our existing staff. And you talked about mobility there. Candidates leaving within 2, 3, 18 months, however long that may be. But if you're an employer and you're investing in your existing workforce and you're helping to retrain, or you're seeing that candidate X has got a certain skill set that we're actually really short of right now, but they may be very good in the current role that they're doing. But if you're willing to invest in upskill and reskill them and see where those transferable skills that they
you want the payback.
You're going to get a more invested workforce. You're going to get a more loyal workforce. You're going to spend less money on recruitment. You're going to spend less time with headaches about, okay, well, we know we've got a talent shortage here in our team. It might be data. It might be, I know, green skills, whatever it may be at the moment. And we can talk about that a bit more down the line. But you need to be able to, and employers now more than ever need to be able to look at their workforce and see, okay, what's our internal mobility like before we then go out to the market and look at hiring from our peers or other sectors that we know we've hemorrhaged staff to.
Who is your client base, Greg? I mean, you seem to work for both sides of the equation, both for the recruiters, so both for the employers and the employees. I mean, do you see your role as primarily filling job vacancies for employers or finding positions for job seekers?
It's a good question. It's a symbiotic relationship, isn't it, David?
You need
one, otherwise you don't have the other. It very much, in a market such as this, you can be very candidate-led, because the candidates can be king right now. And if you've got a very good candidate, you can take them to market and you can find them a role that's applicable to their skill set and desires and needs right now. But I wouldn't say you'd always lean one more towards the other, because if you are so focused on your clients, well, you're never going to have any talent to take to your clients. But if you're so focused on your talent, you're not going to be able to find them a job because you've not got any relationships with your clients. So it works both ways. And I said, it's the symbiotic nature of the two that enables either and both to succeed.
Sure. But your salary presumably is paid by the employers. You get a commission from the employer for finding somebody to work for them.
Yes. Is that right? Yes, that's how it works.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the difference between you and a football agent, for example, is a football agent will take a percentage of the...
They had a lot more money, Phil. That's the big difference there, I tell you.
In terms of the dynamic of the game, we think of the football agent who is the player's representative who's also taking a cut from the clubs, whereas you're more the...
Yeah, I would say the big difference there is they are very talent focused as opposed to relationship with... Again, they've got to have relationships with the clubs that they're dealing with in order to be able to put their product in front of them. That's how it works. I would say from a recruitment perspective, it's very different. It's a very different jacket and outfit you're wearing in a football agent. You can't just lump it all into the same box. I think in order to be a good recruitment consultancy and agency, you've got to have partnerships. You've got to be able to go and be able to consult with, I don't know, Balfour Beatty, your Taylor Woodrow's of the world, the Costains of the world, about what their difficulties are. What challenges are they facing? How can we work together with you to overcome those challenges? Okay, well, this is what we're finding out in the market. This is what we're finding a couple of your competitors are doing. This has worked really well. This hasn't actually worked well in some areas. We think your business could look at this, and how can we adapt and work with you to change that? And that's where the partnership comes into play, because if you're very transactional as a recruitment agency in your relationship with your clients, you'll do okay and you'll do fine. But in order to succeed and really help shape the market you work in and build long forging existing and long standing relationships, it needs to be a partnership. And we're obviously in the coalface every day. We're speaking to candidates all the time. We're speaking to their competitors, their clients all the time. So it's having that confidence with one another that you can have the trust, and trust comes into this absolutely, that you've got each other's best interest at the heart each time you're having a conversation and you're sitting down face to face helping overcome whatever issue it may be at this point in time.
Going back to where we are now in the construction industry and looking forward today, what are the hot roles, I won't say either trades or professions, but roles in the construction industry that employers are coming to you and say, we need more, more left backs, more strikers. Who are the really in demand people that you find easy to find work for or easy to get pay rises for?
That's a very tough question, because geographically that will change. Project based that will change as well.
You're in London, right?
Yes, London, but we cover Randstad's a national agency, so I look after in terms of from an infrastructure basis, we sit on the board for our infrastructure work. So from a blue collar perspective, right the way up to your technical white collar roles, there's shortages across the board. Like commercially is and planning from estimating is really difficult to find really good estimators, really good planners, CREs. But when you've got big major projects on, I don't know, you look at the TRU works, or we're going to have the, any TransPennine upgrade, the rail upgrade, sorry. So, or any sort of, shall we say, the A47 works where you're upgrading the roads to dual carriageways, the sub-agents, you need them in abundance.
But loads of roads jobs have been cancelled. I would have thought there would be masses of people with that experience who haven't got enough road, enough jobs to go to. I would have thought there'd be plentiful.
There isn't. If you look in London, it's quite a quiet, depressed market from an infrastructure perspective. But when you look at the projects that are currently underway nationally, you've got, I just mentioned, obviously, the A47, you've got the A1, you've got, I mean, the bane of my life on a once a week commute down to Maidstone, the M25 Wisley interchange.
Yes, you know that.
Yes, that's an absolute nightmare. What is it, BMW JV Near project, where they're putting a load of laybys in. We've still got a lot of, like, you can remember, the HS2 still employs over 30,000 staff. That's nearly probably 2.5% of the current construction working population, and they're still recruiting.
Have you got that contract? Are they a client, HS2?
We work with the contractors on HS2. Yes, we do a lot of work with HS2. You look across at all the nuclear work at the moment. Was it Hinkley? That's still on the way. It's going to be there for a long time. Sizewell's just about to start. There are a lot of big projects all around. We got the impending CP7, so Control Period 7 for rail, that in 2 years' time is going to be fully underway. I know a favourite of yours, the Lower Thames Crossing, Barbara ABI decided to award a couple of months ago. but if that were to hit in 2026, I know there's been further delays recently, but if that was to hit as well, you've got there's not much. Look, this isn't new to the industry. There's not much slack in our system when it comes to headcount and employees. So all it takes is a little tipping of the scales, and you're looking down a very worrying precipice. And bear in mind, all this is on the backdrop of what is a very depressed build and residential market at the moment. Post-election and the easing of interest rates, you're going to reignite and re-energise a residential market that's going to have further emphasis on new road improvements from a civil engineering perspective. So right now, yes, is it hard to recruit? It's quite hard to recruit, but we can recruit and it's okay and you're doing very well. But all it takes is the market to really open up, and we're not too far away, I think, from that happening. Next 18 months, I think there'll be a real shift towards a more of a buoyant market, because the last 2-3 years have been very difficult. And then you can really see where it's going to be difficult across the board to hire. And bear in mind, 2 years' time, we're going to have a load of new skills that are going to be required in this construction industry as well. If you look at 2020, for example, since 2020, there's been an 83% increase in green skills construction job adverts. Those are jobs that weren't even advertised 5 years ago.
But how isn't the word green, though, just be attached to old-fashioned jobs like, you know, plumbers and glaziers? That suddenly they're a green job.
No, I think that's a rather...
What do you mean? What do you mean by a green
job? I say
job?
That's an ignorant way of looking at it. I think when you look at green energy, you're looking at HVAC, you're looking at solar panels, you're looking at the conversion of wind energy onto the national grid.
Okay.
So from that, I mean, what is it? National grids, the ESO, so they've got 58 billion expansion for high voltage transmission network. You add into that the wind energy that's got to come onto it as well. That's a significant project nationally that needs to be undertaken, that's going to gobble up a lot of staff. So when you look at it from that perspective, you can see where the struggles come. You add in the adoption of AI and data analytics that's coming into the construction industry as well. I think more now than ever, there's so much pressure on contractors to build on time, on budget, the margins that they're working to, that they then have to adhere to such high standards of health and safety and quality, that to embrace technology, which they're going to have to do with the data analytics on that. Those are new skill sets that we've got to drag in and pull in from other industries into our industry, into the construction industry. And that's where we talked and alluded to it earlier. That's where the skills-based interviewing and hiring needs to really ramp up to get that in place so that we don't struggle in the years to come.
How hard or easy do you find it to if you're looking for a data analyst, do you ring up some rocket scientist tech geek and say, come and work in the construction industry? Do they go, oh, that sounds interesting? Or they go, I don't want to work in the construction industry, I'm a tech geek, I'm a rocket scientist.
I think that's where your value as a recruiter comes in, isn't it? Because if someone was to tell me that right now, and with my skill set, I'd probably say, well, no, that's not applicable. But if then they're going to talk to me about, well, actually, this is where your strengths lie, this is what my client's looking for, this is how I really see that you two can have a homogenous relationship and really add value to my client, this is the sort of work they do. This is because you've got to remember, a lot of people outside the construction industry don't really understand what goes on and how technical and how interesting this market that we work in is.
Absolutely.
It can all be seen as a lot of muck and bullets, can't it? And it has an antiquated view from the outside looking in. But the industry has gone through such a change over the last 15 years, even the last 10 years, at such a pace as well, that those roles that never would have even really been considered for as a construction role now really become construction-centric and construction-focused and real value adds to an organisation. And if you, when you're working on margins such as, I don't know, 2-3% margins, if you can find that tiny percentile gain, that value add from wherever it may be, well, that's a great advantage you have over your competitors and the projects and packages that you will then win off the back of it and really drive your company forward.
We're back in football again. All the analysis in football.
I'm guilty of that. You're going to have to deal with that all the time, I'm afraid.
I mean, Greg, when a lot of people, when they're talking about the skills shortage at the moment, which has been with us for a long time, they mentioned
Brexit.
It's
nothing new.
It's not new. But Brexit is often cited as one of the main factors for the worsening of the skills shortage.
Yes.
I mean, if you remember, you know, a few years ago, every builder in London was Polish, for example. You know, they've all gone back. You know, all
a
the
bit of a generalisation there, David.
I know, of course, yeah. I'm generalising, but you know, a lot of
but I understand the sentiment. Yes,
people said, you know, well, one of the effects of Brexit will be that all these foreign workers are going to go home. Is that true? And are you able to recruit people from overseas?
Oh, you can absolutely recruit people from overseas, as long as they've got the correct visa, they've got the correct right to work within the UK, and you've got to make sure that you've got robust processes and practices in place to make sure that that's the case. But you are absolutely correct. The industry was hammered because of Brexit, and we lost a lot of the workforce that could no longer see it as desirable or were able to actually work in the UK who previously could have done. So That was particularly from a blue collar perspective, that was a real hammer blow to our industry, which we've been recovering from ever since.
Mm. Especially in London, I guess.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah.
So do you actively look overseas? I mean, you're a Dutch company.
We are a Dutch company. Yeah.
Ultimately. I mean, but do you actively look overseas for people to fill jobs in the UK, or do you concentrate on the domestic workforce?
It, whoever applies or whoever's on a database for a job, as long as they've got the right to work within the UK,
right?
Then and they've got the correct skill set, we'll work with them and with our clients. It's not we actively seek X, Y, or Z.
No.
It goes back to what I was talking to Phil earlier. Look, who can I get as the best person? Who can my team, who can my business get as the best person to fill this job? If they happen to be female, if they happen to be European from whatever it may be, they happen to be 65, it doesn't really matter as long as we find the right person for that job.
Yeah.
One of the traditional features of the construction industry is that projects happen everywhere, often remote locations. Think of the motorway building program. A lot of people have to live out of caravans for maybe a year or more. What are the trends? Are people these days less willing to travel and live on the road, or is that seen as part of the appeal? Or I want to travel, I want to get around, or is it harder to get people to do that?
When the major projects were all so centric to London, it was more difficult to do that. So if you want to go up and work on, I don't know, the LNERU or any major infrastructure scheme up north, well, you might have the bright eyes, bushy tails wanting to work in London and be associated with those projects. But as they've lessened in London and the civils infrastructure world has really migrated to, and rightly so, to improving what is it, we've got such a poor northern infrastructure, particularly from a roads perspective and rail. Obviously, we've got so much investment that needs to be put there. But workers will migrate to where the work is. If you've got a skill set, you will go to where you know you've got long-term, particularly now, stability on a long-term project that fits your skill set. So, but that's a big upheaval for some people if you've always been based X and you need now to go and be based Y. So that's, again, it's the challenge to try and find that talent that is prepared to be mobile, that's prepared to move for a job. And again, that's where it comes down to knowing your talent, knowing your workforce that's available to you, what drives them to be able then to marry them up with your client.
And also, just getting from A to B is much harder. I used to be able to get to the motorway in 10 minutes. It now takes about 40 minutes.
Just that's why these projects are being undertaken, Phil. That's why we need to improve the roads and the rail infrastructure, because it's not fit for purpose right now.
Right.
I think we've covered it.
Things
are going to get really, really bad, and you're going to fix it. Is that right, Greg?
As long as we have a place at the table and we continue our partnerships with our clients, then we can guide them on the changing that needs to take place. I think the most important thing is we discussed the reskilling. I think the reskilling of existing talent and making sure that you have a mobile talent workforce that you can see where those transferable skills is integral to helping fight what we've got. But I also think that more so than ever, the really hiring for skills is going to be prevalent more so than it's ever been, and it rightly so needs to be prevalent in the construction industry, because it will aid the industry to overcome its diversity issue. It really will.
Yeah. I mean, we do get a lot of people contacting us on a fairly regular basis, you know, banging on about we need to get more women in the into the industry, more ethnic minorities into the industry, yeah. And I tend to sort of like automatically put it to one side because people have been saying that for as long as I've been writing about construction. Never. But I imagine that now it's more important than ever to really exploit as wide a range of skills as possible, because, you know, you can't afford to say, you know, this isn't a job for a woman, you know, it's...
And I think that mindset has to change. Yeah. And I think construction's been one of the worst at really adopting that mindset. And there's been a lot of good work from charities and people for women in construction and making it more diverse. And I think construction sometimes is its own worst enemy, where it's the subconscious bias, shall we say, of, oh well, he went to the same university, or they worked with Joe Bloggs, who I know is really good, so fair enough, I'll hire them. Well, that's okay, but are they actually the best person for the job? And have you therefore overlooked someone who has a similar or even better skill set, but hasn't hit your unconscious bias, and therefore you've probably taken on a subpar hire for what needs to be? Like, I mean, what was the stat? Let me see if I can dig this out, guys, because it's really interesting.
Okay.
Here we go. Yeah. So from research from Deloitte shows that hiring for skills is 2.5 more times predictive of job performance than work experience. It's 5 times more predictive of job performance than education.
Oh, so, that's interesting.
So that is, and that's from Deloitte. So that's research from Deloitte tells us that. But the skills-based hiring, I think if we were to hone in on anything, the skills-based hiring and the reskilling is really an agenda. And look, it's not just me sitting here trying to push this. This is me sitting here off the back of meetings with our clients pushing the same agenda and really looking to pivot their antiquated and established, shall we say, recruitment methods more to where they need to be steered to.
But I absolutely agree with you about the whole education thing. I mean, okay, I wouldn't want a surgeon who hadn't been to medical school.
Of course, yes.
For most jobs, I mean, I remember when I did my O-levels, and that's GCSEs for younger listeners, we were told it's terribly important that you work hard. You must get the right, you know, the best grades for this. And then as soon as you do A-levels, it doesn't matter what your O-level results were. And as soon as you got your A-levels and you got to university, no one at university said what A-levels did
you get. It doesn't matter now.
And 5 years after university, it doesn't matter whether you've got a degree or not. What matters is what you've done and what you can do.
Exactly. It depends the industry you operate in. I think construction is such a phenomenal and fabulous industry when you look at it in terms of the journey that someone can go from. You can go from being a brickie or a carpenter's apprentice, whatever it may be, to actually
to
the boardroom. And that's why I think we're probably going to segue too far down apprenticeship levy and how that needs a massive reform, particularly in the construction industry. But that's what's the beauty of construction. And then that goes exactly to what we're talking about, is that skills-based hiring.
Yeah.
Well, Joe Bloggs or Joanne Bloggs would have been an unbelievable brickie. But there's so many transferable skills that candidate had that led them to be leading the company and sitting in the boardroom and steering the growth of wherever it is that company's being taken. And that's why I love construction, because you've got the opportunity to do that. And very rarely can you do that in certain industries.
You also see there's a name for it. Is it the Peter Principle, where people get promoted just beyond their abilities? Is that what it's called?
Yes.
You know these things, David.
I don't know what it's called, but I'm familiar with the idea. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yes. You
and that someone might be, I mean, you see it a lot in schools, that they might be the best teacher and suddenly they're not doing any more teaching because they're head teacher. And they're
They're doing admin. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that tends to happen, I think, in a lot of industries.
Yeah.
But I think probably construction is different in terms that it's a lot of people who end up in the boardroom do start, you know, at the bottom of the pile very often, sometimes, you know, as a labourer on site or on the tools. Others go in, obviously, at graduate level. But I think that it is easy. It's a more mobile environment, isn't it?
I think that's where construction needs to work on its brand a bit more.
Yeah.
Like construction has so many avenues you can go down. It's such an interesting and tangible industry. You can actually see what you're putting your career into more often than not. But it's done a lot to work on that over the years. But that's why you get a lot of people that haven't gone to university that have come into the industry that have been able to work their way up. They're incredibly talented, intelligent individuals that have been able to have a way into an industry that then has been able to utilize their skills. But I think what construction is doing better these days is being able to get the better graduates that it's never really been able to get hold of and be able to now put them on their graduate schemes and be able to harness their skills. It still needs to do a lot more, I believe, but it's working on it. And that's where the change of recruitment process and practices can really help attract that talent that is probably not really given the construction industry a second glance. I know, Phil, David, what's your thoughts on that? I know you've probably heard a lot from me today. Does it fly against a lot of what your views on the subjects are?
No, I don't think so.
No, I think it has always been the case of the image of the industry, the dirt and the mud and the weather and getting your hands dirty and getting stuck in. And people think, oh, no, I don't want to do that. And that's what people think of as construction. And as we've been discussing, it's not that. Well, it is that, but it's everything.
Yeah,
it's
so much more. Yeah.
But also, I think that because people's perception of the construction industry is so wide and varied, you can look at anybody who's been on YouTube can see all those ridiculous prank videos which people on site have been doing. And you look at that and your heart sinks, because if that's the average person's image of the construction industry, people having bags of cement emptied over their heads and stuff like that, that's clearly just,
a shitty end of the industry.
But then you look at something like an engineer working on Crossrail or HS2 or something like that. It's almost like a different industry, because we talk about the lack of women in the industry, and that's true. Certainly at site level, it's a very male orientated environment, but in the design office, you've got a lot of female engineers working there, some very high profile figures as well, working on some big infrastructure projects, really impressive people, with incredible skills, and they fit perfectly into that niche. They're working on a big construction project, but they're not out there on site wading through the mud. It's a different, so there's really, what I'm trying to say, I suppose, is that there is a niche for everybody, really, in the industry. You just got to find the niche.
I don't even consider construction as an industry per se. It's a sector. In the same way that if you work in the health sector, there's a big difference between being a chiropodist and a brain surgeon and a pharmacist. And they are so detached and divorced from each other in what they do. They just all happen to work in the field of health.
Yeah, true. Yeah, same with construction.
Right.
Right, that's it then.
I think we're done.
I think we've <we're> solved that problem.
We've fixed it. Greg Shaw from Manstead, thank you very much for joining David and I on this episode of Reconstruction. But from all three of us for another episode, thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.